Good afternoon, everyone. It's lovely to have you all here today at our Bloomberg Sydney office. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, which is the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'd like to pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. My name is James Bell. I'm the Managing Director for Bloomberg here in Australia and New Zealand. Bloomberg has been here locally since 1987, and we've supported the financial services ecosystem and the associated communities ever since. We're grateful to be a part of the industry here, and we're highly honored to be joined by such an esteemed guest today, the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, Michelle Bullock. Ms. Bullock was appointed to her current position on the 2nd of April 2022. She's the Deputy Chair of the Reserve Bank Board and the Deputy Chair of the Payments System Board, and a member of Chief Executive Women. Prior to her current role, she was the Assistant Governor for the Financial System. Ms. Bullock has also held a variety of senior management positions at the bank. She was the Assistant Governor for Business Services, the Assistant Governor for Currency, Advisor for the Currency Group, and before that, the Head of the Policy Payments Department. She holds a Bachelor of Economics with honors and a Master's from the London School of Economics. The Australian economy is in an interesting place. We're moving beyond the pandemic and straight into an energy and food price shock that is boosting inflation expectations. Rising rates and weak confidence have already seen house prices decline in the two largest markets of Sydney and Melbourne. Falling real wages and the drag on demand as international travel spend shifts back offshore are very much likely to weigh on growth in 2023. Australia's $2.2 trillion economy has recovered surprisingly strongly from the pandemic, thanks to massive fiscal and monetary stimulus. The labor market is the tightest in nearly half a century. Consumer spending is still strong, and business confidence is still fairly solid. Today, we'll hear reflections from Michelle Bullock on the central bank's quantitative easing program and the lessons learned from its experience with unorthodox policy. We'll begin with some opening remarks from the Deputy Governor, and we'll move to a fireside chat moderated by Swati Pandey from Bloomberg News. Thank you all once again for joining us here today. We're honored to have you here with us, and please do enjoy the event.
Self-organised. Well, thank you all for the opportunity to speak with you all today. So I'm going to use the time to talk about two issues. The first is our review of the bond purchase programme that we used during the pandemic. And the second thing is the bank's financial statements for 2021-22. Now, the two issues are related because while the bond purchase programme was a policy response to extraordinary economic circumstances, it has had big implications for the bank's balance sheet, profits and capital. So I'm going to give you the punchlines up front. In terms of the bond purchase program, the review concludes that it broadly achieved its aims, and I'll talk through that and some of the lessons. But one result of the change in the bank's balance sheet is that the bank is going to report a substantial accounting loss in its 2021-22 annual accounts, and as a consequence, negative equity. This won't affect the bank's ability to operate effectively or perform its policy functions. And over the next few years, the bank will return to positive earnings and to positive equity. But first of all, to the bond purchase program. So the bond purchase program was introduced in November 2020 as part of the bank's second package of monetary policy measures in response to the pandemic. It was a complement to the yield target, the term funding facility, forward guidance and a very low overnight cash rate. Under the program, the bank purchased Australian government securities and semi-government securities in the secondary market to lower the structure of interest rates at maturities of between 5 and 10 years. Unlike the yield target for three-year bonds, the bond purchase program did not target a particular level of yields. Instead, it set a quantity of bonds to be purchased over a set time period. So the initial program involved purchase of $100 billion worth of bonds. That was split 80-20 between AGS and semis, and that happened over 6 months. So that was a rate of about $5 billion a week. And then the program was extended several times. First, there was a further $100 billion from April to September 2021, and that was also at a rate of $5 billion a week. And then from September to November 21, at a rate of $4 billion a week, so we lowered it a bit. And then finally, there were purchases of $4 billion a week until mid-February 22, and at that point, the program ceased. So all up, the bond purchase program resulted in the purchase of $281 billion worth of Australian state and territory government bonds. Now today, some of you may know, the bank released its internal review of the bond purchase program, and that was discussed by the Reserve Bank Board at its September meeting. It's a very long document, so I'm not going to go into it in detail, but I highly recommend you read it. It's a good read. It discusses the deliberations of the bank and the board in establishing and maintaining the program, the effects on the financial markets and economy, and the financial implications for the bank. And it concludes with an assessment of the program. So I'll first draw out a few conclusions of the review, and then I'll discuss the financial impact on the bank's balance sheet in more detail. So in assessing the bond purchase program, the review looked at its impact in four key areas. Firstly, its success in lowering bond yields and funding costs more broadly and the exchange rate. Secondly, its support for economic growth and jobs. Thirdly, its implications for market functioning. And finally, its effect on the public sector balance sheet. The first conclusion reached was that the program was successful in lowering bond yields. We estimate that it lowered Australian government bond yields by around 30 basis points and yields on semis by a bit more than this, so lowering the margin. This in turn helped to lower borrowing costs to historical lows, and it contributed to a lower exchange rate than otherwise. Now this is an important conclusion because this was the impact that the program was intended to have. Second, the evidence suggests that the program supported economic growth and jobs. Now, given that this was a very novel tool and it was implemented as part of a package of reinforcing measures, it's actually very difficult to isolate the specific effects of the program on the economy. But it is clear that the program, along with the other policy measures, contributed to a strong recovery in economic activity and a sharp drop in unemployment. And a further key benefit of the package of the policy measures was to provide insurance against the very serious downside risks the economy was facing during the pandemic. Third, we concluded that purchases of bonds by the bank helped market functioning in times of stress. Even as the bank held a larger share of bonds on issue, there wasn't any negative impact on functioning more generally. And this outcome, we think, was assisted by the features of the program: the fairly short announced purchase horizons of 6 months and less, the flexibility to adjust the size, the composition, and the timing of auctions in response to market conditions. And finally, the review highlighted that the program had an impact on the public sector balance sheet in a number of ways. So it will result in a financial cost to the bank because as the economy has recovered, interest rates have had to rise. And as I'll discuss later, this will mean that the interest paid on some of our liabilities will for a time be higher than the return we receive on our assets, and as a result, the bank will be making losses. But the economic stimulus from the program contributed to higher revenues for the government, helping to reduce the budget deficit relative to earlier expectations. And it also resulted in government debt being issued at a lower fixed cost than otherwise. So although the review concluded that it achieved its aims, those four things I talked about, it did highlight a number of lessons. On the positive side, as I mentioned, it was actually quite flexible with its relatively short purchase horizons and the ability to adjust it. And indeed, this flexibility, along with the communication of developments in the program ahead of time, allowed for a relatively smooth exit from the program. And that's particularly as compared, as we know, with the exit from the yield target, which was not quite so smooth. On the other hand, just as we concluded in the review of the yield target, if more weight had been given to possible upsides scenarios on the economy, the assessment on the relative costs and benefits of the program might have been different and might have led to alternative decisions. All up, the review concluded that it would only be appropriate to consider the use of a bond purchase program in the future in extreme circumstances. That is, when the cash rate target has been lowered as far as possible and there still needs to be more to be done. Now, this brings me to the bank's balance sheet and its 2021-22 financial results. So the review of the program, the bond purchase program, discusses the losses that the bank is expected to incur over coming years because of the return on its assets will be less than the interest paid on its liabilities, and those liabilities are primarily balances in exchange settlement accounts. But in about a month's time, the bank will release its annual accounts, in which it will report a large accounting loss and negative equity. So what I want to do now is step you through the main features of the bank's balance sheet and the outcomes for 2021-22. It's going to be dry. Hope you bear with me. So the bank's balance sheet actually is relatively simple. On the asset side, it essentially holds domestic bonds, either outright or under repurchase agreements, and it holds foreign exchange reserves. Now, prior to 2020, you can see from the chart, the bank's balance sheet was between $150 billion and $200 billion. Most of the assets were either foreign exchange reserves or domestic securities held under repurchase agreements, and they were as part of the bank's liquidity management. It held very few bonds outright. Now, this changed dramatically during the pandemic when, as I mentioned earlier, the bank undertook novel measures to lower interest rates. This resulted in the bank's balance sheet expanding significantly. The bond purchase program, combined with the other policy responses to the pandemic, resulted in the bank holding around $356 billion in Australian government securities and semis at the end of June 2022. It also held a further $188 billion in assets associated with the term funding facility. So, substantial increase in the bank's balance sheet. Now, the bank's main liabilities are deposits by financial institutions or exchange settlement balances and government deposits and banknotes. Now, prior to the pandemic, as you can see in this graph, banknotes actually accounted for most of the bank's liabilities, with deposits making up most of the rest. Similarly to assets, the bond purchase program and the term funding facility resulted in a significant change in the bank's liabilities, with exchange settlement balances increasing to over $450 billion, easily becoming the biggest component of liabilities. The bank also holds a number of equity reserves on its balance sheet, and I'll come back to those in a minute. Now, what about earnings? Well, the Reserve Bank's earnings come from two sources: underlying earnings, which the most important of which is net income, and valuation gains or losses on holdings of government bonds and foreign exchange. The bank's net interest income is the difference between the interest it receives on the assets and the rate it pays on its liabilities. Very simple. It earns a market rate of interest on almost all its assets. And on the liability side, the bank ordinarily pays interest on most deposits, but importantly, it does not pay any interest on banknotes outstanding. So prior to the expansion of the bank's balance sheet in 2020, it paid no interest on over half its liabilities. Now, if the average rate, very simple, if the average rate earned on assets is greater than the rate paid on liabilities, the bank will have positive net earnings. And historically, this has indeed been the case. Underlying earnings, basically net interest income subtracting operating costs, it's been positive since the bank was established in 1959, as you can see from this graph. Over the past couple of years, underlying earnings have been particularly strong. In 2021, underlying earnings were $8.2 billion. This reflects interest earnings through the year on the larger portfolio of Australian government bonds, which were purchased during the various pandemic programs, while paying interest on almost all liabilities. So no interest on banknotes and no interest on exchange settlement balances until May 2022. The other component of the bank's earnings is valuation gains and losses arising from fluctuations in the value of its assets due to movements either in exchange rates or changes in the market yields on securities which we hold outright. And as the bank applies fair value accounting in its financial statements, such movements have an immediate impact on earnings. So over the past year, The valuation losses on the bank's holdings of domestic bonds due to the rise in bond yields were around $40 billion. In addition, because we purchased many of these bonds at a price higher than their face value, the amount of this premium will also be recorded as a loss over the life of the bond. And over the past year, this accounts for a further $5 billion valuation loss. These valuation losses were partially offset by a $1 billion valuation gain on the bank's foreign assets from the depreciation of the Australian dollar over the year, but clearly not a lot. So the net impact of these two forces is the Reserve Bank will announce a significant accounting loss when it releases its financial statements in October. So this leads to a question of how such a significant loss as this, as you can see in the table, is treated. But first of all, I want to just provide a little bit of background on the bank's capital and reserves, because it's important to understand how this works. So the Reserve Bank holds a number of reserves, and the most important ones for the purpose of this discussion are the unrealised profit reserves and the Reserve Bank Reserve Fund. Both of these reserves are set out in the Reserve Bank Act 1959. There's also a number of accounting reserves, but I'm not going to discuss them any further because they don't impact the results and the point of this discussion today. So the unrealised profit reserve, it functions as the name suggests. Unrealised valuation gains are reflected in profits, but they're not available for distribution. They're placed in a reserve to either absorb unrealised losses in the future, or they become distributable when profits are realised from the sale or a maturity of the underlying asset. The Reserve Bank Reserve Fund is the bank's main reserve and historically has constituted the bulk of the bank's capital. The framework used by the Reserve Bank Board to determine the target balance of the Reserve Bank Reserve Fund has been in place for a number of years. And under that framework, capital was assigned to cover market risk arising from the bank's portfolio of foreign and domestic asset holdings. There was also a small amount of capital assigned to cover credit risk arising from very small exposures to commercial banks that are not collateralised, but it's tiny. Now, I want to emphasise that the target balance of the Reserve Bank Reserve Fund is not a minimum level of capital that needs to be maintained at all times. Instead, it's really a benchmark for the board to consider when it provides advice to the Treasurer on the bank's capital and dividends. Now, the Reserve Bank Act sets out how these reserves are utilised when the bank makes a profit or loss. So, as I said, unrealised gains are not available for distribution, and they're transferred to the unrealised profits reserve. Unrealised losses are first absorbed by the unrealised profits reserve, and if they exceed the balance of the unrealised profits reserve, they're offset against other sources of income. So that's underlying earnings. That's our underlying earnings. Now, if after this there's positive distributable earnings, the Treasurer will determine, after consulting with the Reserve Bank Board, any amounts that are transferred from distributable earnings to the Reserve Bank Reserve Fund, the capital, and the remainder of distributable earnings then is payable as a dividend to the government. So that's how it typically works. If, however, unrealised losses are so severe that they totally deplete all the other income, the underlying earnings, and they totally deplete, they do that, then the Reserve Bank Reserve Fund is used to absorb the losses. Now, what happens if the Reserve Bank Reserve Fund is not big enough to absorb the remaining losses after all of that? And the Reserve Bank Act is silent on that. It doesn't say. So, how has this played out in 21-22? So in 21-22, the Reserve Bank recorded an accounting loss of $36.7 billion. Underlying earnings were $8.2 billion. They were substantial. Valuation losses were $44.9 billion. There was only $500 million in the unrealised profit reserve. So that meant that there was still $36.2 billion in losses to distribute in the manner I've outlined. The Reserve Bank Reserve Fund absorbed $15.4 billion of this before it was exhausted. That leaves around about $21 billion in losses. And that's going to be recorded as accumulated losses on the bank's balance sheet. Yep. This means that when we take into account some other reserves that we have, that the bank has negative equity of about $12 billion. Now, if any commercial entity had negative equity, assets would be insufficient to meet liabilities, and therefore the company would not be a going concern. But central banks are not like commercial entities. Unlike normal businesses, there is no going concern issue with a central bank in a country like Australia. Under the Reserve Bank Act, the government provides a guarantee against the liabilities of the Reserve Bank. And since it has the ability to create money, the bank can continue to meet its obligations as they become due, so it isn't insolvent. The negative equity position, therefore, will not affect the ability of the Reserve Bank to do its job. And in fact, a number of central banks in other countries, you can imagine, have a similar issue. Large bond portfolios that, if marked to market, will result in substantial accounting losses and potentially negative equity. The Reserve Bank is actually a little bit unusual in using market value accounting without an indemnity from the government. So, for example, both the Bank of England and the Reserve Bank of New Zealand use market value accounting for securities that they've purchased under their equivalent bond purchase programs. But their profits are not affected by mark-to-market gains or losses because they're offset by a matching entry that reflects the value of the indemnity from the government. So they're slightly different. So despite the fact that the bank can continue to operate with negative equity, the board's view is that it is important that the bank return to positive equity over time, and the board has communicated this view to the government. While it hasn't sought a capital injection, the board has indicated to the government that it expects future profits will be retained by the bank until the bank's capital is restored. And the Treasurer has endorsed this general approach, noting that under the Reserve Bank Act, the issue of distributions to the government is considered each year. One reason why we expect profits in the future is that the majority of the bank's domestic bonds are now carried on the balance sheet at a value less than these bonds will be redeemed at on maturity. So capital gains are expected to be realised as these bonds mature. This will add to the bank's earnings in future periods. And furthermore, as I noted earlier, the bank's continuing to earn seniorage on banknotes that it issues. And there's $100 billion worth of banknotes out there at the moment and continuing to rise. Offsetting this, however, is the fact that many of you have realised the next few years, the interest the bank is earning on its domestic bond holdings is likely to be less than the interest it is paying on its exchange settlement balances. And indeed, as monetary policy has been tightened over the past 5 months, the interest rate paid on exchange settlement balances has been rising, and we're now in the position where, on average, the interest being earned on our assets is less than the interest being paid on our liabilities. In other words, underlying earnings at the moment are negative. Now, it's difficult to be precise about how long this situation will last or how big these negative earnings will be. The review of the bond purchase program, if you go and have a read of that, you'll see it sets out four scenarios to illustrate how the bank's future earnings may vary with different assumed paths for policy rates. We can use these scenarios to get a little bit of an idea of potential future path of the bank's earnings and net equity position. The bank would incur losses for the next few years as the interest rate on ES balances would be higher than the income on the bank's assets. But valuation gains on bank's domestic bonds will boost earnings, and within a few years, it's expected that they will more than offset the negative underlying earnings. And at this point, net equity will start to improve. There's another factor that will lead to an improvement in profit and net equity, and that's the reduction in the size of the balance sheet. So as I noted, prior to the pandemic, the more usual situation for the bank was a much smaller balance sheet in which banknotes, which pay no interest, accounted for most of the liabilities. Now, as the bond portfolio matures, exchange settlement balances will start to run down and we'll move back more towards a situation which will generate positive income and much less exposure to interest rate risk. There's a final thing that I think is worth noting, though, that the AGS that the bank holds are actually liabilities issued by the government. So while the bank's going to report a really large valuation loss in 2021, the government's debt issuer, the Australian Office of Financial Management, they're going to report a significant financial gain. So for the whole of government, the bank's valuation losses on this part of its portfolio are going to net off against the AOFM's gain. So in conclusion, the bond purchase program was implemented by the bank as a package of measures designed to provide insurance against very bad economic outcomes as a result of the pandemic. The bank's internal review of the program suggests that it broadly achieved its aims. But as I've set out, one outcome of the bond purchases and the other policy measures has been the bank will report a substantial accounting loss in its 21-22 annual accounts, resulting in the bank being in a position of negative equity. This will not, however, affect the bank's ability to operate, and as the bonds mature and the bank's balance sheet declines, the bank will once again return to positive earnings, and these earnings will result in the bank returning to positive equity over time. So thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Michelle. My name is Swati, and I write about the central bank and economics here at Bloomberg. Michelle has a hard stop at in about 20 minutes' time, so I'll jump straight into questions. So from what I understand, Michelle, the hurdle for deploying unconventional policy in Australia again is pretty high, unlike in for the Fed or the BOE. Is that right? Are the chances close to zero?
I wouldn't say they're absolutely zero, but one of the conclusions I think the board has drawn from the experience is that it's only for use in extraordinary circumstances, and it's only for use when, in particular, the cash rate is absolutely run out and we've got no gas left in the tank. So I wouldn't categorically rule it out, but I would say that the bar is very high. Yes.
Right. Later this month, we'll have the first monthly inflation report. So everybody's pretty excited to see what the numbers are going to be. Do you have expectations around what the number will be? And is there a certain figure that will really worry you?
No, we don't. I think there's a little bit of water under the bridge to go with the monthly CPI numbers. So I think everyone will be looking at them and trying to figure out what is the noise and what is the information in monthly. So I'm not so sure that quite immediately we will be looking at monthlies. What I would say is that our forecasts for inflation are to peak at about 7.75%, 8% towards the end, early into next year. So those are the numbers we're currently working with. So I'd say we've got new forecasts coming out soon. I think that would be the November Statement on Monetary Policy will have new forecasts coming out, but that's our current expectations, and that's what we're working with.
So it will not, this monthly figures, these won't have monetary policy implications for the October meeting?
I think it's unlikely, because I think at the moment what we're really doing is trying to figure out how the monthly numbers, there needs to be a little bit of water under the bridge with the monthly numbers to see what sort of information content is in them, because they're not the full CPI.
Right. In Australia, there's a bit of a debate going around whether we'll have a soft landing or hard landing driven by the current tightening cycle. And the RBA has said that, it is seeking to cool inflation, but it's also looking at keeping the economy on an even keel. Do you think the cash rate is already close to restrictive territory?
That's a very difficult question. This gets into debates about what people think about the neutral rate, and that's typically the way people define it in terms of the neutral rate. In real time, I would hesitate to give a guess as to what the neutral rate might be. So I'm not sure it's necessarily in restrictive territory yet, but it certainly was evident that we needed to get it up from the very low levels that it was. And the board and the bank are focused on really the outcomes that we're seeing in terms of inflation and employment, and we'll be looking to see whether or not there is opportunities to taper a bit and slow the pace, but we haven't got a preset path. I think we've said that a number of times, there is no preset path on this yet.
Right. the Fed, the Bank of England, and some other major central banks are, you know, telling us that they are determined to crush inflation at the cost of economic growth. RBA is an outlier there, right, with Governor Lowe recently saying that outsized interest rate hikes may be coming to an end. And that has also stirred a lot of debate in the market and, you know, around market pricing. What I want to ask you is, what are the key differences that sets us apart? Is it the household debt that, you know, that you're worried about, or is it something else that, you know, the monetary policy path in Australia is looking different from other countries?
There's a couple of reasons. The first is that inflation isn't as high here as it is elsewhere. That's number one. You would see in the UK, the US, the inflation rate there is much higher, and the core rate of inflation is much higher in those countries than it is here. And it's for different reasons. In Europe and the UK, there's a big element of energy prices. In the US, there's a big demand overstimulus issue going on. The second reason is that wages here have not responded as they have overseas. So if you look at the US and the UK in particular, wage rises are actually up around 5%, 6%. So there's much more of an underlying momentum, if you like, in the inflation psychology in those countries. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a little bit of a shift in inflation psychology here. I think the concern is that there is a little bit, and that's why we're raising interest rates. We want to make sure that an inflation psychology doesn't get set. But at the moment, there's at least a few reasons why we are in a slightly better position, I think, than some other countries in terms of inflation.
Right. I'll just sneak in a couple of questions before I open to the floor. With all the collateral damage across global markets from the USD strength, is there a case for coordination among central banks to stop or manage the surge?
Well, you're going back many decades, I think, towards suggesting that. Exchange rates can play a very positive role, and at least in Australia, we've typically thought of it that way because it gives us flexibility and the ability to run our own policies to a large extent without necessarily having to follow what others are doing in other countries. We're not entirely immune, but it does give us more flexibility. I think it's a more concern possibly for some of the emerging economies. For those reasons, for many of those countries, quite a few, particularly in Latin America, they have issues with much of their debt is issued in US dollars, which has implications potentially for financial stability in those economies. Most of our debt is issued in Australian dollars. We're not beholden to the US dollar in that sense. So I don't think necessarily coordination is the right thing here. I mean, in a sense, the US dollar is responding to relative economic conditions and inflation and interest rates in the US relative to many other countries. That's what you would expect.
Right, yes. Question about China. How concerned are you about what's happening in China's economy? What are the biggest risk factors that you're seeing at the moment? Is it commodity prices, people flow? Is it the financial market conditions, housing market there? All of it.
Well, in one word, yes, concerned about China. It's only one of three sort of concerns internationally, I suppose, the other being the US and Europe, and it's all for different reasons. China, I think the main concern, or two main concerns, one is their apparent zero COVID approach, which means that it's likely to continue to be a little bit volatile, impacts on supply chains, impacts on demand, so there's that. The second issue is the property market, and that still has not worked its way out. I know that the government and local governments in particular are trying very hard to support the Chinese property market. It accounts for about a third of the economy. It is huge. So it's very important for the healthy economy. It's also important for steel demand and hence for iron ore. So concerns about China really around the zero COVID and the property market and what that potentially means for growth in China and hence the flow on to ourselves.
So what is the biggest risk for us then?
Internationally, I think it's not just China. I think the biggest risk is that you have rising interest rates in Europe and the US. US has, as I said, I think it's got excess demand and it's trying very hard to bring that down, and its interest rates are going to have to, continuing to go up quite sharply. Europe has got its own problems. It's got inflation, but it's also got a massive energy shock, which is going to impact their production. So with that, those two things plus China, I think the outlook for the world economy is looking quite uncertain and quite worrying. And that obviously has implications for us because of the tendency to flow through to commodity prices. So this is something at the moment that I think is on a reasonably, it's very uncertain and it's on a bit of a knife edge.
Right. On that somber note, I'll open it to the floor. Okay, let's start. We have a moving mic. Please introduce yourself, your name and which organisation you're from.
Thank you. Eric Johnston with The Australian. Thank you for the speech. It was really, really interesting. My question, I guess, is in two parts related to the speech. The first being, as we get into a more uncertain environment, is there mechanically anything that the Reserve Bank can or cannot do with the negative equity position? And also the second part, I guess, is the tenure of the bonds on the books. Should we assume that as they mature, that's the period when it's going to start getting into positive?
I didn't catch the end of the last question.
That's should we assume as those bonds mature, the average tenure of those bonds, is that when the Reserve Bank will start getting into positive equity position?
Right. Okay. So on the first question, no, we don't believe that we're impacted at all in our ability to operate. As I said, we can create money. That's what we did when we bought the bonds. We created money and bought the bonds. So we can do that. It doesn't impact our... But obviously it would be good to get back, and it is important to get back to a position of positive equity at some point, because I think it's important that we have a solid balance sheet. But we can absorb volatility over time, and that's one of the advantages. As to when we start to get back to positive equity, that it isn't just dependent on when the bonds mature. It's also dependent on how far interest rates rise, when they rise, when they come back, because that's going to affect underlying earnings and profits, and that's the other chunk that's... So there's going to be two parts to it, and how quickly it comes back will depend on both those things.
There's the gentleman at the back there. Oh, we have.
Yao Yaoji, Bank of China. Thank you, Michelle. Yeah. As well know, the board decided to not sell the bonds. But I had a quick check. Please correct me if I was wrong. It may take 5 years because the bank bought bonds broadly across 3 to 10 years. So it will take 5 years to let maybe half of them to mature, and eventually 10 years to let all of them, you know, gone. Yep. So my question will be, where the RBA worry about this is too long, and in which circumstances the RBA will consider to sell the bonds? Thank you.
Sure. So there's one other, you're right, it runs off, and the last bonds won't run off until 2032, so 10-year bonds. In the next couple of years, though, there is a big chunk that's going to run off, and that's the term funding facility. So the term funding facility, we're lending at 0.1% to the banks, and our assets are obviously not earning. They're paying us 0.1%, and that's not going to offset what we're having to pay in exchange settlement balances. So once that runs off in the next couple of years, that's actually going to make a big difference. So it's not just the bonds that we bought through the bond purchase program. That program actually is going to have, the runoff of that program is going to have an important impact on that as well. If you go to the bond purchase program paper, the review, you will see that there's a graph in there which shows you how the bonds run off. And the way mechanically it will work is that there's sort of a tipping point. where they run off enough that we're making enough valuation gains, realised gains now on the maturing of those bonds that are running off, and it's enough to offset the losses, including our underlying earnings from the fact that we've still got the banknote seniorage. So you think of it as a bit like a tipping point. There comes a point where the positives start to outweigh the negatives on underlying earnings.
We have a question.
Deputy Governor, Neil Mustin, I run a trading fund. I just want to discuss on quantitative easing, so the various aspects of bond buying, yield curve control and so forth. Do you consider those superpowers maybe a little bit too nuclear to invest in one person to decide the timing and the quantum of applying them and removing them? And also, do you think appropriate measures, which is what the Reserve Bank Act really, do you think lawmakers really had any idea of what they were vesting in the Reserve Bank?
Didn't quite catch what the last question.
The last bit is all I can see in the Reserve Bank Act is that appropriate measures will be used to achieve its charter. So do you think lawmakers really had any idea of the inflation potential of the powers that they've vested in the Reserve Bank?
Would I call the bond buying? No, I wouldn't call them superpowers. And in fact, they helped at the margin, but really, it's the interest rate, it's the policy rate that does the work for the bank. That is the main tool. So I wouldn't think of the other things as superpowers. I'd think they were just things that at the margin we were trying everything we could. Think back to March 2020, and people seem to forget it was we were facing a disaster. 15% unemployment, GDP was going to drop by 10%, there was going to be a morgue in the domain for all the dead people. You know, this was catastrophic. In those circumstances, these were things at the margin that we thought might assist to help the economy. Did the lawmakers understand that these sort of... No, I would think in 1959 when they drafted the Act, they didn't have any idea of the sorts of challenges and the sorts of tools that the central bank might have to use.
One more question.
Good afternoon, Deputy Governor. Hans Lee of Livewire Markets. I note in the review you guys released this morning, there was talk about how the ultimate cost of this program may not be felt until 2033. So I'm curious, well, two questions from me. I'm curious whether there was any consideration of a more active approach to quantitative tightening like there is at the Federal Reserve. And secondly, whether the RBA has, you know, best and worst case scenarios around how this will all, you know, develop and pan out, and if so, what are they?
Sure. So, the board did consider the issue of whether or not to actively run down the portfolio. It decided in the end not to, and I think for a couple of reasons. The first is it's at the margin, really, as I said earlier. The main impact, we're not constrained on the upside like we are on the downside. So we couldn't lower the interest rate any further, but we can move the interest rate up. So that is the main tool, and that's why we haven't categorically ruled out, but we've said currently we have no plans to sell before maturity. So that would be the reasons for that. But yes, it's been actively considered. Sorry, your second question was...
Just around whether the RBA has, you know, a best-case scenario and a worst-case scenario developed for
Oh yeah, so there's a little bit of that in the bond purchase program review, where we do the scenarios for various interest rates and what that might imply for earnings from the bond purchase program, and they're the numbers that come out of it could end up costing anything, I think, between 58 billion and in the worst case scenario and 20 something billion in the best case scenario for interest rates. One thing I would point out, though, is that, and I think this shouldn't be underlooked, is that the economy, because of all these extraordinary measures, the economy has done very, very well. And that means that, and in fact, I think I saw this morning in the paper that the budget deficit is looking a lot better this year. And one of the reasons is because welfare payments are down. And that's because unemployment is its lowest level in 50 years. And the bond purchase program, as part of the package, helped contribute to that. So just considering the financial loss, if you like, in isolation I don't think is particularly helpful. I think you have to think about it across government and across the economy.
Could you take one more question?
I'll take one more.
Okay, one more question. Last.
Governor, news. The bank's reviewing its communications with the Australian people at the moment. Should the RBA adopt what the US Federal Reserve does and have a press conference after every cash rate decision?
After every cash rate decision, meaning whether we do anything or not?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Well, that would be interesting. That would mean 11 press conferences a year.
We'll be there for them.
And I suspect the quid pro quo of that is there'd be no speeches because we'll have already been out there completely overexposed. Look, ultimately, we do want to be accountable and we do want to be transparent. Our view at the moment is that it's most appropriate for us to have press conferences when we have something significant and important to say, but not just because. That's our view at the moment. I think we'd be putting that view forward, but there's room for alternative views. And as you know, there's a review of the Reserve Bank going on at the moment, and that may well be something that they will consider.
You have had four 50 basis point cash rate rises in a row, though, and no press conference apart from one.
Yes, but we've had plenty of speeches.
Okay, thank you so much, Michelle. Thank you for your time, and we look forward to hearing from you more and to hosting you again at our offices.
Thank you, Swati. Thank you, everyone.